figure you and I have a chance to start over.
Most people don't get that second chance.
You really feel that way about me?
No. I think you're a greedy, two-faced bitch.
What?
There's no reason I should trust you, but I want to.
Let's get together. I'll say it first. We all love fun. And it's time for Kill Me Cast. Yeah, it's time for Kill Me Cast.
Welcome to Kill Me Cast. Here is your host, Francis Rizzo III.
Thanks, Bernard. Welcome to all the Val Pals listening out there to a new episode of Kilmer Cast. I'm your host, Francis Rizzo III, and I'm here to talk about the films of Val Kilmer, one of the most truly beguiling American film actors of the modern era. On this episode, we'll be checking out Kill Me Again, a 1989 crime drama that most people forgot he ever made, coming on the heels of a run of much bigger films. Joining us to chat about the film and Kilmer's role in it is a film writer you've read just about everywhere, including the New York Times, Vulture, and Vice, as well as his books on Pulp Fiction, Richard Pryor, and more. Now he's also the host of the Fun City Cinema podcast. Let's welcome Jason Bailey. How are you doing today?
Hi, Francis. Thanks for having me, man. It's a thrill and a pleasure.
I'm glad you could join us. I'm really excited to approach a film that really is not one that I really watched in my first run of Kilmer fandom, and definitely one that I did not know much about as I've gone through the years. So the fact that you actually watched it before was also pretty great, because then you have a little more perspective to bring to it. What I wanted to start right now is talk about the Fun City Cinema podcast. Can you talk a bit about it?
Well, sure. Thank you. Well, yeah, the podcast is very new. We're only one regular episode and one bonus episode in, and we're working on episode two right now. But it's basically a spinoff of the book that I've spent the last about 3 years working on, which is coming out next fall from Abrams Books. And it's called, the full title is Fun City Cinema, New York and the Movies That Made It. And basically, it's a 100-year study of the history of New York City cinema and where it lines up with the history of New York City itself, and the degree to which so many of the great New York movies are also very much about what the city was at that like precise moment when they were made.
When, you know, I think about my show, we have about 45 episodes planned. I imagine with all that history of New York film, you've got quite a few episodes ahead of you.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, I mean, that was really sort of where the idea of doing a podcast comes from, is because, like I said, it covers 100 years. You know, it's done in 10 chapters. Each chapter covers a decade. Each chapter focuses on sort of the quintessential New York movie of that decade, with a few others sort of, you know, obviously thrown in for context and so forth. But that's so much history to cover in a single book. And through the process of researching and writing the book, I found so many more sort of interesting side stories and just great movies and great intersections that there just wasn't space to cover in the book. And as I was thinking about ways to promote it and things to sort of do with this period while I'm waiting for it to be able to come out, the idea of taking some of those stories that there wasn't space for, and some of the copious research that I'd done, and some of the interviews that I conducted for it, and turning that into a non-narrative, you know, produced storytelling podcast suddenly became very appealing. So that's kind of what the podcast is and how it ties into the book.
Will the show go chronologically through the history of the film, or will you jump around?
It will absolutely, there will be no rhyme or reason. It will jump around all. I mean, our first episode is about Do the Right Thing, you know, which is 1989. So that's sort of well into the history. But the next episode is called Starring the NYPD. And it's about sort of, you know, the New York cop movie from the 1970s through to the present day. You know, we have some that are films, you know, more like that sort of thematic, running over long periods of time. Others that go clear back into the, you know, 50s, 60s, up to the present day. So it's really just more kind of what we're moved to talk about by the moment. Obviously, Do the Right Thing is a movie that's on a lot of people's minds right now. Mm-hmm. Cinematic representation of policing is very much on people's minds right now. So sometimes it'll sort of be informed by what's in the culture right then. And sometimes it's just cool stuff that we want to talk about, fun movies that we want to sort of dig into a little more deeper than I was able to on the page.
That's great. You know, with my show, I decided the order I would go with is start with his first film and then go to his most recent film and then bounce back and forth, because as I was looking through the filmography, there's large swaths that most people wouldn't care much about the films that he made. But the problem is that I definitely hit two of the films I most wanted to talk about right off the bat, which was Real Genius and Top Secret.
Right.
Is there a film that you're going to hold on to for maybe later in the run that you're really looking to get into?
It actually, yes. There's one of the things that sort of got me, that spun me into the idea of turning it into this kind of a podcast, was I had actually contemplated writing a whole separate book about Death Wish.
Mm.
Just because there was so many interesting sort of side stories. It's, you know, when you're writing a book like this, it's almost like you're sort of spinning a spider web. Mm. And every story can lead to another, to another, to another. And you have to sort of determine the point at which you have to stop spinning.
Mm.
But Death Wish has like six really interesting side stories, in addition to its sort of place as like a New York crime movie and how it tied into New York crime at that moment, which was a very bad one. It also inspired this whole subgenre of New York vigilante movies. Mm. And vigilante exploitation movies, which also, you know, went outside the bounds of the city. It has all of these sequels and ripoffs and remakes and all of this stuff. But, you know, there's also the really interesting story of Brian Garfield, the author of the book, who disowned the movie and spent the rest of his career fighting the movie, speaking out on the movie, doing penance for the movie almost. The episodes that we're going to do on Death Wish, which are a little ways down the line, it's kind of like six short stories about Death Wish, just because there's so many things to talk about with that. So yeah, that would probably be the one that fills that niche for me.
Well, I can't wait to hear that, because I did not know that about Death Wish. Most of my knowledge of it is basically Bronson and sadly Bruce Willis. So
right. Right.
So that'll definitely be interesting to check out. Today, we're talking about Kill Me Again, but I was curious, what's your favorite Kilmer film?
Oh boy, Spartan.
Spartan, that's a underrated pick, but definitely yes. One that's well-deserved.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I like, you know, obviously he's incredible in Tombstone. You know, I mean, like, I like Top Secret is a treat. Real Genius is real genius. Like, I like all of the sort of go-to ones, but whenever, if I can ever find an excuse to recommend Spartan, I will. Just, and like, I think Mammoth as an action filmmaker, I wish that film and Heist before it and Red Belt after it had been more financially successful, because I the idea of him sort of him bringing his style and sensibility to action cinema, I think all three of those, it yielded some really, really interesting results. And that film, the sort of the brevity and efficiency of the writing and directing in that film. And I think him and Kilmer were a really good match. I think the sort of like fierce intelligence and professionalism that Kilmer's most interesting characters tend to have, like, just snapped right into place into that Mammoth universe. I love that movie.
It's a great film. It's actually interesting that the way that the series breaks down, that's our last episode is Spartan. That's how it ends up.
Wow. It's a good one to go out on then.
Yeah, it'll definitely bring together a lot of the ideas and themes inside of Kilmer's career and gives us a real jump off as this is the way we should end it.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that, even though it is well down the line.
Yeah.
So before we dive into Kill Me Again, we've got to go back in time.
Gather round. As we put Kilmer in context.
So, Kill Me Again was released in theaters in America on October 29th, 1989. Looking back, it was a pretty busy time around the world. Same-sex civil unions were legalized in Denmark, which is the first time legislation like that was passed in the world. The anti-communist protests that led to the reunification of Germany were kicking off. A massive 6.9 earthquake hit the Bay Area of California, killing 63 people and postponing Major League Baseball's World Series. And then this one I found was interesting when I was looking back. Congress passed an updated Flag Protection Act to try to overturn the Supreme Court's decision that flag burning was protected free speech. Now, this new act was overturned itself by the Supreme Court. And then annoyingly, there was a third attempt in 2005 from Utah Republican Bob Bennett with co-sponsorship from, any guesses who the co-sponsor was?
Oh, boy.
2005?
No, give it to me.
New York Senator Hillary Clinton.
Damn it.
Yeah.
Damn it. All hard.
That was not, that's not something I wanted to go back and find.
Yeah.
This one was never voted on, and it died a quick and quiet death, thankfully. And we can still burn flags, even though not something I'm really interested in, but I'm happy to have protected free speech.
Yeah.
The thing is, Bennett then died a few years later after making a deathbed apology for Republican anti-Muslim rhetoric and for his party's role in bringing the world Donald Trump. I feel like we're going to see a lot of those deathbed apologies as the years go by.
Yeah, I'd like him to come a little sooner. I'd like him to come when they can do us a little bit more good.
Yeah, let's do these rapid fire. So looking back at the entertainment landscape, the Billboard chart was led by Janet Jackson's Miss You Much, followed by Sowing the Seeds of Love by Tears for Fears.
And then
Listen to Your Heart from Roxette. That's a legitimately solid top three.
That's kind of a steep drop off from 2 to 3. I'm not a Roxette fan.
I like Roxette. I mean, it's good Swedish pop music. You can't argue with Swedish pop.
Fair enough.
You know, what's nice is that there's some variety there in the genres. You do not get that now.
Yeah.
It's not a lot of different kinds of music you hear there. Yeah. I don't think a song like Sowing the Seeds of Love could even get airplay today.
No, you're right. And oh man, I forgot that 89 was the year of Rhythm Nation.
Yeah, another great album. I mean,
yeah. Oh, listen to that.
Yeah.
Listen to them.
It's a shame.
Tears for Fears doing like their damnedest to do a Beatles song and much nailing it. That is like a real like Rubber Soul Revolution Yeah. I like that a lot.
Yeah, the thing that strikes me about that song is that it gets down to business so fast.
Oh, yeah.
It just jumps right in, flows from verse to chorus, and then you get this very chill breakdown goes on, and then some trumpet, and then an organ run. I mean, it's got everything.
It's a great song.
I mean, I guess you can have everything when the song is like almost 5.5 minutes.
Right.
You have plenty of room to shove everything you want into a song, and that song really made the most of its time.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike so many of the recent episodes where we've gone back in time, the rest of the top 20 here is mostly mainstays. They're things you would know, like a pair of songs by the New Kids on the Block and Love Shack by the B-52s and Love Song by The Cure. But at number 19 was an oddity. Call It Love by Poco. Do you know that song?
I don't.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds vaguely familiar, but I can't place it.
This was its 10th week on the chart.
That rings not a single bell.
it's very odd because usually when the song is on the charts that I don't recognize, it's either I don't know the band, but I've heard the chorus at least, or I know the band, I've never heard that song from them.
Yeah.
This one's a total mystery.
This is like, I'm feeling kind of that like Berenstain Bears thing right now. Like, was I in an alternate reality where that song didn't exist?
It's very strange.
All right.
On the top 20 of Billboard, that means it got radio play, especially at the time frame, 1989.
Absolutely. And in 1989, like, I was still listening to the radio. So that's
exactly.
That's wild.
That's okay. The thing that, like, a lot of the films that we've covered recently are 80s films. And 80s songs really stuck around because they were used a lot in MTV and in movies and TV. And this song, just gone. I've never heard of Poco. I don't know what that, like, I have no history of Poco at all in my life.
Yeah, I'm suspicious of this whole thing. I'm I'm going to do some research and get back to you. Am I being gaslit right now, Francis? Are we doing some gaslighting?
Okay. I would love to do that in a Willow episode. There's a song on the charts called Two Occasions by The Deal. And again, I play this for my wife, and she's like, no, I've never heard of this song. But it was the number 3 song in America, which it was crazy that it was so popular. And apparently, the thing is with that band, people in the band became famous. There was like Babyface as a producer and some other people. So I get that. Like, it was like a band that maybe was just breaking out and the people in it were very talented, but the song never made it across to people where I listened. I was fine with that. But this is pretty straightforward mainstream rock and I've never heard of it.
Not a clue. All right.
On television, Cheers was the most watched show in America. And the top 5 slots were held by NBC shows, which was pretty much the norm at the time. NBC dominated. In fact, of the top 20 shows that week, 11 were on NBC, which, that's crazy now to have that much dominance. I know CBS has a lot of shows that rank highly, but to see over half of the top 20 shows is incredible.
Jeez. right. Yeah. Well, and CBS also rules now because, like, they speak to the demographic that still watches these shows on network television live.
Exactly. Yeah. And anyway. They just leave their TV on.
Right.
And what I found interesting about that time frame was that two TV movies were in the top 20, which doesn't happen anymore. Yeah, TV movies don't even exist. One was Do You Know the Muffin Man, which starred Pam Dauber, Stephen Dorff, a very young Stephen Dorff, and Brian Bonsall, who was the kid Andy from Family Ties.
God. This is just, that's just such a 1989 TV movie cast.
Like, exactly.
That scans.
About a nice light topic, sex abuse at a daycare center.
Of course.
And then you had Roxanne, the prize Pulitzer, the story of Roxanne Pulitzer, who basically, I don't think anybody today knows who she is. I think that really just went away, that story of her life. I remember when I was a kid, she was a big deal. She was a Playboy and everything, but no, she just disappeared. I don't even know if she's still alive, actually, at this point.
Wow.
I guess, you know, it doesn't make sense for TV to traffic in TV in movies anymore. It's just, you have so much prestige television and you have, you know, all these cable channels to do movies, that to do a movie like that, it seems like a waste of money. I mean, I'm trying to think of the last time we had a big TV movie.
Like a TV movie event. It's been a very long time. I mean, if you're taking cable out, if you're not talking like HBO or whatever, yeah, that's, but they, I mean, guys our age, I think we're roughly the same age. Remember that, you know, like there was, every network aired a movie on, like they all aired a movie on Sunday night, either a made for TV movie or a theatrical movie making its debut. And then most had like one other night of the week when they would also air, like they would do a 2-hour block or a 3-hour block for a movie twice a week.
Yeah.
And at a certain point that they just stopped doing that for either theatrical films or made for TV movies that they didn't bother making. But that was a huge part of the TV landscape, like in the 80s.
Yeah. I mean, when they aired Black Panther the other night, that was so different. Yeah,
right. Right.
The last one I remember really that made an impact on me was The Stand. And I don't even know if you can consider that a movie because it was so huge.
Miniseries. Yeah. Yeah.
But although each episode, I think, was 2 hours long, so.
Right, right. I will say that, yeah, I remember a few Stephen King ones after that. Like, there was, like, I think he had, like, a deal with ABC or something, because they had, like, the two-part Stephen King ABC movie event was a thing for a while. Like, Storm of the Century the Mick Garris Shining. Like, those were kind of a big deal. But, like, that's, you know, he was such a brand name at the time that was almost just like doing a series. It's just like, here's our new Stephen King movie.
I'd like to see that come back, but I guess that's probably not going to happen anytime soon.
Probably not.
On the New York Times bestseller list, Tom Clancy led the way with Clear and Present Danger. It was in its final week of 9 on the top of the chart, while Robert Fulghum was number 1 on the nonfiction chart with All I Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten.
God, that book was inescapable in 89. You're right. Oh, everybody had it. Everybody had the poster, like all the classrooms and all the... Yep. Oh, God. Yep.
I was curious how this compared to the charts now. And on fiction, it's really more about individual books now than superstar authors. Like Clancy, I did notice that at number 2, Stuart Woods had the 54th book in his Stone Barrington series.
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine reading 54 novels about one character?
No, but they're out there. They are out there. Wow.
Who has the time to read the same character 54 times?
Yeah.
Like that's mind-blowing that somebody, like how many adventures could you come up with for this guy 54 different ways? I get it. There's a lot of Bond films, but there's not 54.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, like if you got a long running, like, you know, they came up with more than 54 Jessica Fletcher mysteries for her to solve. It seemed like murder kind of followed her around. Like if I heard Jessica Fletcher was coming to town, no, I'm leaving. I'm going to go on a nice long vacation because somebody about to die.
Though admittedly, those only took about an hour to enjoy, whereas
that's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
Stuart Wood's books, I'm sure, take quite a while longer to read.
Fair enough.
And on the nonfiction side, fluffy little books of essays like Fulghum's, they're nowhere to be found anymore. No, it's all politics and social issues. And, you know, I get enough of that everywhere else. I really don't want to read about it. I'm sorry. It makes me sound like, you know, vacuous, but I'd rather read about movies.
Yeah. No. Me too. And I don't know, a year or so after when we're talking, like 99 or so, I was working at a bookstore. And that was right in that huge wave of the chicken soup books.
Oh, yeah.
And that's, I think, it hadn't occurred to me at the time, but a pretty direct descendant of that sort of Robert Fulghum thing, just the, like, the, you know, the sort of feel good essay fluff book. Big.
Yeah, I was wondering if why those kind of went away. Those self-help was such a huge genre in the 80s, and it really went away. And I just think maybe it's just the internet.
I think so.
You know, just go online to look up their problems and and find their answer instead of reading a book.
Yeah, Google their problem and, you know, spend the afternoon surfing. Yeah, probably so.
WebMD for the soul. At the box office, Kill Me Again didn't quite crack the top 10.
No.
It earned a whopping $66,013. Great.
How wide did that open? Like,
not very.
Yeah, I didn't even, I was born and raised and spent my first 30 years in Wichita, Kansas. So, I mean, we only got the mainstream releases, and then like independent movies, if they did really well in the major markets, would like eventually make their way to like one screen. But I have no memory of this film in a theater at all.
Yeah, put it this way, it doesn't show up in the chart for that week. So, yeah. I'm pretty sure it may be opened up, maybe East and West Coast.
Right.
And that's about it. Topping the charts that weekend, its third week in theaters was Look Who's Talking, which earned $14 million. It was a very different time. When a talking baby movie was the number one film in America. It was followed by the debut of the horror film Shocker. To me, that film only exists in VHS because that's the only way I ever saw it. It was on the shelf in my video store.
And memorable box art.
I remember that art so vividly. The purple arcs of electricity. I've never actually watched it, though.
Me neither.
It only exists there on the shelf in my in my memory. It earned $6 million in its first week. And then in third, it was the first week of The Bear, which just fell short of $5 million. You know the film The Bear?
I do. It's it's that the French filmmaker whose name, of course, escapes me now that I'm trying to think of it.
Yes, Jean-Jacques Annaud.
Thank you. Yes.
Who did Quest for Fire.
Right. And that bear, isn't that the bear that ended up in The Edge?
I believe so, yes.
I think that's the bear from The Edge. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. It's kind of weird to think of a movie like that being a big success. Again, it was a different time where you could do a narrative non-speaking film about a bear and get people to come and see it in theaters.
Yeah, definitely. And not a kid's film, if memory serves.
No, it's not a kid's movie. Yeah. You know, it's kind of dark.
It's not like dirty or anything, but it's not like geared at kids is more what I mean.
Yeah, it's dark because the bear has to escape hunters and it gets pretty scary at times.
Right.
The rest of the top 10 featured Next of Kin, the hillbilly thriller starring Patrick Swayze, the Al Pacino thriller Sea of Love.
Very good.
Michael Douglas in Black Rain. It really was a lineup of superstars, leading films. The Fabulous Baker Boys.
Oh, magnificent movie.
Matthew Modine in Gross Anatomy.
Wow. That's a very, very, very late 80s touchstone release.
Definitely. Here's one that I didn't actually remember when I saw it. Immediate Family.
Oh, God. James Woods, Glenn Close, Mary Stuart Masterson.
Three for three.
Wow. Okay. I figured I'd blow it on the three name actress, but I brought it on home. Yeah. I never saw that one either, but I have a very vivid memory again of the box art. I was working in video stores in the early 90s. I remember that image, a very soft focus image of like James Woods and Glenn Close touching her tummy. Yeah.
Yeah. It was an adoption drama that I guess has had no impact really on culture because nobody talks about that film.
Yep.
But there was a film that had less impact right behind it on the chart. Worth Winning.
Oh God!
If you can name these, no, not Nick Nolte.
Worth winning. Oh God. Nope.
Yeah, this is a romantic comedy starring Mark Harmon, Madeline Stowe, and Leslie Ann Warren.
Oh God. Okay. Yeah, that does sound vaguely familiar.
So Harmon plays a weatherman who's offered a bet that he cannot get three randomly chosen women to fall in love with him over a 3-month period of time and accept a proposal of marriage.
It's a very different time at the movies.
I mean, that movie, I have no memory. It's not even a kino release, so I could at least I would see it there. But no, nothing at all about Worth Winning. I don't remember seeing it in the store. I don't remember seeing it in theaters. It just totally missed me and somehow was the number 10 film in the week.
Yeah, they really tried to make Mark Harmon happen as a movie star.
You just had to do in more summer school movies. I could have taken that.
Just been a series, yeah.
I love summer school. So why don't we get into the film itself that we're here to talk about?
All right.
So the writer and director of Kill Me Again is John Dahl. And he shares the co-writing credits with David Warfield, whose brief writing credits include the Cuba Gooding Jr. Border Patrol drama Line Watch. So his career went great. Dahl, on the other hand, obviously, you know, he's done well.
Yeah.
He was making his debut here as a feature director after making his break doing music videos for Kool & the Gang, which is something I did not know until I looked it up.
Wow. No, me neither.
Yeah, I wouldn't have figured that from his films. It doesn't seem like a natural connection, but
there
you go. And though he's not really, I wouldn't say, a top-tier director, he's certainly carved out a good career. He's been doing prestige television for years. He's every series that you would ever mention, he's done at least an episode of.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, he's best known for the poker drama Rounders. That one has really was caught the zeitgeist at the time with Matt Damon and John Malkovich and Ed Norton. Poker at that time, huge. And that movie really capitalized on that. And I thought it was an entertaining film.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I remember it feeling when it came out, like it was like it didn't quite land initially.
Yeah, it definitely caught on home video.
Yes, but being a huge, like, that was very much the early days of DVD, and that being one that, and, you know, and they were, like, just maybe just a year before that little poker explosion. Mm. But when that happened, that was a disc that, like, a lot of people bought and watched and rewatched because it's a very, there's a high rewatch value for
a lot, very quotable film, paid that man his money.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, no, I the main reason that I... When you sent me the list, you know, to say, hey, what should we talk about? This jumped out at me because it was one that I had always meant to get around to seeing and hadn't, but I had wanted to because I liked John Dahl so much, not even so much for Rounders, which is a terrific, but for the two films that he did right after this one, the sort of 1-2 punch of Red Rock West and The Last Seduction.
Yes.
Which... rule, which are just these magnificently crafted little neo-noir, you know, medium to low budget, but so well versed in the conventions of the noir, and yet update them without, it's very precise the way that he updates them and makes them contemporary and, you know, sort of cranks them up content-wise, which he can do without seeming to lose the spirit of sort of the great noir pictures.
Yeah, and working with great casts in those films.
Quentin Tarantino
is fantastic in Last Seduction.
It's an amazing performance. And really, I think, and I won't dwell on this for too long, but I think it's important also to sort of contextualize those films and this one too, that they were coming out and I think in many ways were sort of marketed and maybe even sort of lost in the shuffle of, you know, this huge boom of erotic thrillers that were coming out in the early 90s.
Yeah, as we mentioned before, Sea of Love, it's a big one right there.
Big one. And yeah, it was sort of right at the beginning of that crest. And then, you know, sort of the biggest one being Basic Instinct, which came a couple of years later, which I think is hard. I think it's hard to explain to a young sort of contemporary moviegoer that this was the idea of this, like, you know, erotic mystery making like Marvel sized money when it came out, like adjusted to inflation, like a huge, huge financial windfall and, you know, sort of cultural ubiquity surrounding that movie. Before and after, video stores were just inundated with all of these erotic thrillers with these sort of interchangeable titles and sort of cliche box art because they were fairly inexpensive to make. And this is right before porn was at the click of a mouse. So there was always an audience for it. Like if you put like, you know, a hot young woman on your cover and like Andrew Stevens with a gun, then you would move, you would, that film would be profitable. You would move enough units to make money off of that.
Yeah, I think back to the time and all I can think of is like Sliver and Fair Play and Killing Her Softly.
Like you're saying like the reputable ones. I'm saying things like Snapdragon, you know, like, I mean, every week, every Tuesday when the new releases came, there were like five of these, you know, most of, you know, with like a sort of should have been, you know, leading man, like a Wings Hauser or somebody, and then like a Playboy playmate, and then like, you know, a character actress. And that was like the formula. Those were sort of, and I bring that up because I think the work that Dahl was doing here and in those two other pictures is those movies were sort of in their broad strokes, sort of trying to exhibit a noir influence, but in a way that was clumsy at best. You know what I mean? It was like, oh, you know, maybe they throw a light on the other side of like some window blinds, you know, or whatever. And very sort of stereotypical femme fatales and stuff like that. When you watch these doll movies, this trio from the early to mid 90s, they're so steeped in the traditions of noir, in the characters, in the plotting, in the style, in the worldview. This was clearly a guy who knew his shit, who had watched all of these. And so, like I say, it's really striking how well they're steeped in those traditions while also not feeling like he's trying to be cute and homage-y. You know what I mean? Like they also work, if you haven't seen any of those movies, as just tight little thrillers.
Yeah, I will say some work better than others, and today's is maybe not as well.
That's true too. That's true too.
I will want to point out that Dahl is also responsible for a severely underrated film, Joyride.
Joyride rules.
Yeah, I mean, that Paul Walker film, just fantastic. It's so tense and exciting, you know, and it's not like these other films. It's definitely a change for him, but he was able to master it quickly.
Yeah, well, and it's not the same as these, but it is sort of within the same idea of, it's a B-movie. Like, he made unapologetic B-movies, just tightly woven, entertaining little thrillers that didn't have to cost $100 million and didn't have to make $100 million. And I will also say this, I won't go too deep into it, but I will mount a defense for Unforgettable, which which I think I like, again, because it's a B-movie. Like, it's a silly B-movie premise that I think he takes with roughly the right degree of seriousness. And I like Ray Liotta and Linda Fiorentino in that one. Now, that said, it is definitely, you know, a come down from the heights of Red Rock and Last Seduction.
So. Definitely not on the same level.
Sure.
We get started in this film with a lengthy credit sequence of desert shots with a really repetitive string score that I hope you like, because you're going to hear it a lot. I've never heard a film use the same little repetitive notes over and over and over and over again.
Yes.
This is so droning.
Yeah. I think a composer might have thought he was Philip Glass. That's that's my best guess. Like, this was a year after The Thin Blue Line, and I think somebody was like, oh, I'll just do that.
Yeah, it didn't
work.
Which is
harder than it looks, yes.
Absolutely. So we're in Winnemucca, which is a population of 4,300, and we meet Faye and Vince, who are played by Joan Wally Kilmer and Michael Madsen. I think a really good pairing here as a Bonnie and Clyde kind of characters. They pull off a robbery by taking advantage of the weakness in men's hearts and the cleavage on Joe and Wally's chest. Yep. And they get a briefcase full of money. We are right at it right away. Boom. There's no real setup of characters. We are right into the plot here.
Yeah. Briefcase full of mob money. You can't go wrong when you start with a briefcase full of mob money.
Yeah. And Faye wants to go to Vegas, but Vince, he wants to get out of Nevada. And I have to say, I think that's the only smart thing that Vince has ever said in this whole movie. Yeah. You know, I'm like, wow, that makes sense. This guy's otherwise a complete lunatic, but he wants to get out. But, you know, they're fighting over this, and they have the weirdest fight. Right in the middle of the road, it ends up with a makeout scene on the asphalt. I really started to wonder, what was the genesis of this relationship? Because they do not seem like two people who would have been together.
Yeah, Yeah, they're a strange match. They don't seem to have synchronous personalities. I will agree. Yes.
Yeah, I was trying to think, where did they meet?
Right.
I can't picture these two people in the same location.
No, and they you know, this is pre-Tinder, so that wouldn't have explained it. Interesting.
So shortly after their torrid middle of the road moment, Faye hits Vince in the head with a rock while he's going to the bathroom, and makes her get away with the money and the car and Vince's gun. If you take out that intro, we are, you know, what seems like a half hour into this film, because we're already well into the plot for Faye's storyline.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's, you know, I don't think you need a lot of those niceties. I don't think we got to spend too much time on some. Like, this, I think, is part of, again, the sort of the efficiency of the noir of the B-movie, that he knows we have a pretty quick sense of who these people are. Because if you've seen enough movies, oh, she's the femme fatale, oh, he's the mug, you know, like that's who they are, and we're off and running.
Yeah, Dahl takes advantage of a lot of shorthand of film and really gets some efficient work out of it. So the story now moves on to Reno, and we meet Jack Andrews, a private investigator played by our guy, Val Kilmer.
Yep.
As he sits and watches, totally detached from the scene, you know, these two guys are tossing his office looking to collect the debt. You know, I was really curious, what did they think they were going to find in this office that was worth $10,000?
It's a good question. It's a legitimate question.
You know, they're going through everything, drawers, books. It's like, this guy is obviously a small-time PI. There's no way he has any kind of money like that. I really was curious what he did with the money. I don't think I ever covered what the money was for
right.
at any point. Did you catch that?
No, I didn't. I mean, I think we're just supposed to sort of assume that it's, I mean, I always assume it's like gambling debts, but
yeah, usually.
I could be wrong about that.
I don't think it was ever brought up, especially since the fact they are in, like, you know, Vegas and
oh,
being Reno.
True.
You know, you think you'd bring that up at some point.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The one thug finds a picture of a woman, a matter, Jack says it's personal. And when the one thug describes her as a piece of ass, Jack slams his hand in a file cabinet, and then in return they break his finger. Do you think the scene could have played with less energy for what happened?
Yes.
You know, there's no investment in the scene at this moment.
Right, that's true. Well, and the trouble I had with this whole business with the picture is that forgive me for getting too granular, the photography, the insert, the way that they shoot the insert, and mm-hmm. the fact that we're also peering at it through like a layer of broken glass.
Mm.
Until Joanne Wally walks into his office 15 minutes later, or however long it is, 10 minutes later, I wasn't sure if she was the woman in the picture.
Mm. Yeah, you have like, no idea.
I couldn't get a clear look at who she was, so I couldn't make I had that period of confusion there because I hadn't gotten a good look at her. And it seems like if you got an insert, you want us to have a good look at her.
Yeah, especially in this film where whoever is handling the inserts, we'll talk a bit more about this a little later, the inserts were excessive at times. You think they could have lingered on that image for a little longer to get us give us a better idea.
Absolutely.
So Faye has now arrived in Reno. She told Vince she was going to Vegas, but this is probably a better choice. Gets away from him, he would find her too easily. Again, we'll talk a bit more about that. The fact that people in here seem to have a really good homing beacon on where people mm-hmm. are, despite
Absolutely.
The fact that this is before the internet, well before the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So while Faye gets settled in the biggest little city in the world, Vince wakes up on the bathroom floor with a bit of a headache from the rock, and he forces an unlucky tourist passing by to give him a ride.
I gotta say, one of my favorite Michael Madsen moments in the movie is him just growling, "That fucking bitch," like right in front of this little kid who found him and like possibly saved him. Yeah, no filter on Double M in this movie.
So I'm curious, how long do you think the dad held this moment against his kid? Because he's like, oh, there's room in the car.
Yeah. Oh, man. That kid was so grounded later.
I think I would have held it against him until at least adulthood.
Yeah, that makes like, sense. No, that would come up at family dinners.
Yeah, the problem is that we don't even know if he actually didn't just kill them at that moment.
That's a fine point. There was not a tearful goodbye scene. That's a good point.
Yeah, Vince easily could have killed them in that moment. Back in Reno, Faye has found a place to stay. I don't want to get too focused on Wally's physical attributes, but the shot of her laying on the bed in her crop top, not much else, looking up Jack's name in the phone book, how is that not a seminal early 90s poster for teenage boys?
Totally, like, big time. No, it's an achingly sexy performance, like through and through. She smolders quite well.
You know, like she's never hurt for work. She's been working consistently throughout the decades. But, you know, I feel like she should have been a bigger star. I don't understand why she didn't break through the way I thought she would.
I think, you know, I looked at the filmography. I had the same question. I was talking to someone about how I was watching this film today. And yeah, it seems like one of those where she never quite found the right vehicle at the right time.
Mm.
And that's all, you know, roll of the dice. I only say this just because it's on my mind because we mentioned Basic Instinct earlier. Sharon Stone had a very similar sort of like not really going anywhere career before Basic Instinct happened. And that was just like lucked out the right movie, the right time. And then she was pretty much a star for the rest of her life. I think mm-hmm. Joanne Vollie Kilmer just didn't ever find that just right role at the right moment.
Yeah, and the closest I guess she got was, besides Willow, obviously, is Scandal, which she was really good in Scandal, but that's not a movie that was going to break through, a movie right. about a British, you know, political scandal.
Yeah, you know, it was a British film. It got like an art house release, but that was about it.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because not that she's always great. You know, I just recently watched her in Twixt and not great there.
She's great in this.
Yeah, she's really good in this film.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, as I mentioned before, there's an amazing awkward camera move from Faye to the newspaper on the nightstand with a zoom in on the headline about a wife faking her death and taking her husband's money.
Right.
It was amazing. I wondered if this was going to be important because right. you know, it seemed like it might have been. It was a subtle hint. You know, right. I think they focused on this headline for approximately 15 minutes.
It's a lingering close-up, yes.
Like, come on, you can give us a little credit, you know, you know, let us you right. know, just see it and glimpse it and move on. But no, this film was really not going to let you fall behind. It was making sure right. No Child Left Behind Kill Me Again.
Yeah.
So as Jack is trying to find a way to scrape up the money he owes, we get some very helpful exposition from his secretary, who's played by Bebe Bech. Yeah. You know, when I saw her, I was like, oh, I know her. And like, and that makes sense why I know her, because she was in Star Trek II, and she was nominated for an Emmy for Northern Exposure and for wow. Doing Time on Maple Drive.
Oh, gosh. That yes, that was a, wait, was Jim Carrey in that?
Yes, it was Jim Carrey's oh, wow. first drama role after breaking yeah. out in Living Color.
Yeah.
Tried to play that. It all seriously. Yeah. You know, she is really good, Bebe Bech. You know, and she's somebody who has played that character role so well. Here, it's like, you know, she might as well just have a sign on her that says exposition.
Right.
Because, you know, she talks to him about getting away to Maine, the place where he used to go with his wife, Kathy. And so now we're at the grave. Again, this film doesn't try to be subtle about anything sure. when it's trying to get you information.
Sure.
So now we know for sure what happened to her. And as he visits her on their anniversary, the weirdest thing about this moment, there's a grave marker with his name on it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a thing you do?
I think that actually is. I think when you get the couple's headstone, like, yeah, it's like the other side is waiting for when he dies, whenever that might happen. It's a little dark.
Morbid.
Yeah, it's a little dark.
Because like, yeah, I was trying to think, I don't remember ever seeing that in a cemetery where there's somebody's name just waiting for them with their birth date and a expiration date waiting.
Yeah, yeah. Big question mark there. Yeah.
I guess very noir, you know, to have death mm-hmm. looming over you, but.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I was like, this is a little weird.
Yeah.
And so as Jack's sitting there picking glass out of the broken frame with his wife's picture in it, in walks Faye.
There you go.
And she is resplendent in this stark white suit. Holy cow.
Yeah. Like, no, this is, I mean, if there's any doubt that Dahl is making a noir and steeped in those traditions, like it is laid to rest by this sequence, the staging of the scene, the way she is revealed, the light, the shadows, like the stems on her, and the way that you know, the sort of the pan up, like Dahl knows what he's doing in this sequence. The scene has been done a million times. He knows it's been done a million times. He knows you know it's been done a million times. And he's going to lean into that in a way that I think is kind of fun. I think he's winking at us pretty broadly here. Like we're all on the same page.
Yeah, I think the only way this scene could have been more noir is it took the saturation out of the film entirely right, at this right. moment. Exactly. And it would have looked great with that outfit on her because
absolutely.
It would have been shining like, you yeah. know, like the sun. So yeah. she tells Jack that Vince is trying to kill her. And after telling her only her side of the story, obviously, because that's how these things work,
sure.
she hires him to fake her death. I have to imagine these things happen. You know, people do try to fake their own death and get people to help them. Do you think it ever works? Because I have to imagine that, you know, if I was involved in a situation where I helped somebody fake their death and we did it successfully, at some point I'm going to slip and tell somebody.
Yeah, I mean, I will say if it has worked, we just wouldn't know about it. I mean, you only hear about the times when it goes sideways.
Yeah, we hear that a lot, though.
Yeah, no, so that
makes
true.
Me wonder.
That's true. No, I mean, I will say this. I feel like a good crime picture has to have a plan that seems sound, but can tear from just like the slightest puncture. And I think that that's one of the things I like about this movie. Like, I think it's got that kind of a plot where it's like you walk it through and you're like, you see how it could have worked. Mm-hmm. And then you see how just that one little mistake causes the whole thing to fall. like the entire House of Cards to crumble. Yeah. And that's good crime writing right there.
Mm-hmm. But we will talk a bit more about how coincidence plays a huge part in
that. Well, that's true.
Because
that's true as well.
There's some things in here where like, well, you know, it really had to be at the exact moment for that to happen.
That's true too.
Yeah, I was really excited when I saw that in the credits that Kilmer's Real Genius co-star, John Grease, is in this film.
Yes.
I'm always up for a John Grease performance because he always brings the weird.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Here he plays Jack's best friend and confidant, Alan. I don't know why he doesn't get more roles. I mean, like, he is the best.
And he gets to say the, I mean, you may, this is the poor guy who has to say, hey, what's the worst that could happen? And it's like, oh, oh, well, you that's know, a setup.
You know nothing good's coming of you.
Nothing, nothing. How dare you be so cavalier?
I wish he had more to do in this film also. That's true. He's in just in a few scenes, but God, every time he's on screen, I'm like, yes.
Yeah, it's good.
So it is kind of unfortunate, though, that cinema lighting hadn't been invented by the time this film was made, because I've never seen a film look quite as murky made at this time frame.
Sure.
I don't know. And it's not a noir dark. You know, noir dark is fine. This is like somebody forgot to flip a switch.
Well, I think this is a first time director working with probably a pretty low budget and maybe not a top tier cinematographer and just kind of trying to find his way through, I would imagine. But yeah, like some of the interiors, some of the bar scenes and things like that. Yeah, it gets a little muddy.
Alan's talked to him about what they're going to do, and they've made a plan, and he's going to kill Faye, you know, not for real, but kill her. So we get to the hotel where she's staying, and this scene where they're doing this flirtatious play acting of her murder is so bizarre.
See, I really dug that scene. I really
It's fun. It's fun to watch.
I think there's something really interesting and erotic happening in this scene, especially with what we know about them off screen.
True.
This idea of sort of role playing and play acting and the way she's sort of prodding him and the way he starts to push back and how they're narrating it. It's a pretty kinky little scene and in a way that I thought worked.
I love the way she manipulates the scene. She pushes him and pushes every button she can with him.
Yeah.
I love that. And I'm all in for how weird this is.
And the symbolism of that blood spill.
Oh my God, the blood spill. Okay.
Like, again, he knows what he's doing with that gag. Like, this is like when Hitchcock cuts to like the train going into the tunnel. Like, we know, it's just kind of got out of your control there, did it? Yeah.
Yeah, we got too excited there.
Yeah, yeah.
But take that out of that. And you have a woman covered in somebody else's blood.
That's weird. You're right. You're right. I glided over that, and I apologize to the listener.
And she has no issue with this at all.
No.
Something's very wrong with Faye.
Yes. Yes, indeed. We knew that. We knew that much.
But I don't know if we knew that much. That she's like, oh, good. Fun blood.
Yeah, exactly.
So he carries her body out to the car, and the camera again lingers on a matchbook where she wrote his name, because this might be important at some point. You never know.
That's the puncture that tears, yes.
After some chit-chat between the two, Jack takes the car and he sends it off into the lake. And yay, we get some more witness, because Kilmer's just standing there staring at this car.
Yep.
And I'm like, what's happening? Because they keep cutting back from the car to his face, to his car, to his face, car to his face.
I think we're just broadly winking at Psycho right then, is what I think.
It's very possible, yeah. The doll's having a little fun there. And then we get the scene where we see Jack swerve to avoid a deer, drive a car off a cliff, and kill his wife.
Right.
I did not expect that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a strangely placed flashback.
I also thought it was interesting how stylistic Dahl shot that.
Sure. You know,
it's real. I get it. It's a flashback. You want to make a difference between what's happening now and what happened in the past. But it's really stylistic and so different than everything else we've seen so far in this film.
That is true. Well, your first time director thing, it's like, no, I got to make this look completely different from the rest of the movie because it's a different time frame. But yeah.
And then we get back to Alan. Yay, Alan's back. And we find out that they're on sacred Native American land.
Right.
And I was like, is this going anywhere? Is there something going to happen with this? Where we're going to have some interesting supernatural stuff going on? No.
Well,
just Grease being weird.
Yep. Yeah. You know, a little bit more at the end, the beginning of a a Native American motif that runs through much of Mr. Kilmer's work in the early 90s.
And beyond.
Yes, yes.
It's amazing how one man can love turquoise so much. After getting back from dumping the car, Jack finds out Faye left. Uh-oh.
Shocker. Shocking turn of events.
Yeah, I mean, she's been so forthright with everybody so far.
She might have used him and ghosted him and not paid him. Who could have thought? Who would have thunk?
I was shocked.
Yeah.
And so she takes a plane to Vegas and Jack's left behind. And he ends up getting arrested as a suspect in Faye's death. Again, shock. How did this happen?
Yeah. Who'd have thunk?
So we're in this interrogation scene. You know, this is where the Kilmer that I know and love really came out. After some very quiet, nothing given moments there in the interrogation. But when he gets not ID'd by the kid at the hotel, suddenly that cockiness comes out.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, yeah. This is the first time, I think, in this movie that Kilmer's really acting.
Right.
You know, he's really just given something here. Because before, he's just kind of floating through the movie.
Yeah. Is this where I voice my concerns with Mr. Kilmer's performance in the picture, or should we save that all for the end?
You can feel free to go for it.
I think he's a terrific actor. We know that. We're on a podcast that's devoted to his work. Mm-hmm. I think he's fundamentally, disastrously miscast in this role.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good.
Without a doubt.
Because here's the problem. Again, as we've mentioned, it's a film that is steeped in the conventions of film noir. The role that he is playing is the sap. Mm-hmm. And I don't buy him as a sap for a second.
No.
He's too fundamental. I mean, like, there's an intelligence to his persona in all of his great performances. And even... like, I could think of maybe one film where he plays dumb convincingly, which is Top Secret. And that's it. That's like, that's a film that exists in a whole other like dimension because it's a Z.A.Z. movie. There is an inherent intelligence that he just brings on screen in everything he does. That is, it's just impossible to get past here that I don't believe that he would fall for the stuff that he has to fall for the plot to unfold the way that it does.
Definitely.
And he has to remain that sap like all the way to the end.
Yeah.
And that's this kind of character. The character is a sap. Through sheer coincidence, I rewatched Detour like 3 nights ago. And like, that's a fucking sap. Mm. Like, that's a sap role.
Yeah.
That's sort of like the prototypical sap. Fred McMurray in Double Indemnity, similar. He's not quite as dumb as this guy needs to be, or as the guy in Detour is. But it's the same idea that they're so horny and fundamentally stupid that they can fall into the trap that is set by this woman, by this praying mantis of skin and seductiveness, and carry it all the way through. The role that Joanne Kilmer's playing is, it seems to me, like a prototype for what Linda Fiorentino is doing in The Last Seduction.
Yeah.
The film itself seems to me very much a prototype.
The plots are very much the same between
very similar. And though, so if you take that one more step, Bill Pullman in The Last Seduction and especially Peter Berg in that movie, that's a sap.
Yeah.
That's how you cast and play and write those roles. And I think the role is written as a sap, and I just don't think it's in Kilmer's range. I don't think he can play dumb the way he has to. And also he can't, there's sort of a fundamental, even though it's usually a character that's driven by lust, there also is kind of just like a naivete to the character. Mm-hmm. And he has this, again, I think is what makes his good work so good. There's a darkness in his persona that's completely wrong for this guy.
Yeah.
Like in that rough up scene that we're talking about, for that scene to really work, like to its full capacity, that character should be surprised that she has unlocked in him this like capacity for sexual violence. And for Kilmer, it barely seems like a deadbolt. Like it seems really accessible to him. Like he's kind of right there in it right away.
Jumps right into it. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And so those elements, I think that the actor who's playing them has to be able to bring those off. And if he doesn't, then he's stuck. He's going to sort of float uncertainly through the bulk of the picture the way I think he kind of does here.
Yeah, and I have to wonder if he realized that he's not right for that kind of part, and that's why his performance is so muted throughout most of the film, because he's trying to be that character, but it's just not in him.
Right, right. And so maybe he's thinking that if he just underplays everything, that it'll come across. That's an interesting theory. I also, honestly, I don't know enough about how this movie came to pass and the sort of the intricacies of its pre-production and production, but I would not be surprised to find out. I mean, first of all, like, I would imagine the reason that it got made at all, that it got funded at all, was because post Top Gun Val Kilmer is in it. I also wonder how much of him being in it is part of, like, I almost wonder if he did it for her.
What I was thinking.
This is entirely guesswork here. This is based on nothing but gut intuition. But like, it's an incredible role for her. Yeah. And she's great in it.
Yeah, it's a showcase for her that he was able to get made by being in it.
I wonder if that's the case. Like,
it feels like it, for sure.
And if it does, and if that is the case, that totally explains it. But it's still not a terribly good performance. Like, no. Hats off to him as a husband, if that's the case. But maybe not so much as an actor. Yeah.
Absolutely. The next scene, we get another one of the film's incredible uses of printed materials. I have to mention this one. I would have let it slide, except this one is so egregious. So we see the first column of a story about Faye's death in a newspaper,
right,
and Jack being a subject. The camera stays on this part of the paragraph so long that even Donald Trump could read it. And it is on screen so long, I actually had the time to think, what's next going to happen? We're going to pan over to the next column? And then we did. We actually panned over and got to read the rest of the article.
Exactly. It's nice.
I couldn't believe it. And then there was a continue on page 14 note. I thought, are we going to flip a couple of pages and read the rest of the article?
Could have happened. You know, it's just, look, it's important not to become too reliant on getting your information from visual mediums. And I appreciate this one stopping to let us read for a while. I think it's nice.
Taking a break.
Yeah. Yeah. A little reading break.
We find out Vince is the one who's reading the newspaper. And when he finds out Faye is dead, he loses his mind and he wrecks the diner. Madsen really can be a very, very menacing presence.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, you want to talk about an actor. Like, I've thought this for a while, that Madsen is kind of an actor out of his time. He could have played these roles in those 40s movies. Like, he has such a great, like, old school mug, and just like, and you know, his physicality is so fierce, and yeah, he's genuinely scary in this movie. Like, the pleasure that he takes in doling out pain is very striking throughout the movie. Yeah. And I did, like, you know, sort of think of it as I'm looking at sort of release dates and things like that. Like, it seems to me quite plausible that Tarantino had seen this when he cast him in Reservoir Dogs. That's especially when you get into the kind of the torture scene a little later on, which we'll get to. Like, I would be very, you know, Tarantino famously sort of consumed everything. I would be very surprised if he hadn't seen this movie when he put him in Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, I imagine this being on the shelf in the video store. And
exactly.
Once he finds out Faye's dead, Vince decides to pay a visit to Jack. And just after a couple of thugs stop by to collect some money, and Vince tries to kill Jack, but he gets away by handcuffing through the desk. I had to wonder, do you think they actually hired a stunt coordinator for the scene, or did Dahl just say, hey, you guys have some fun?
Yeah, just rough each other up a bit.
It's pretty sloppy.
Yeah.
Low budget, obviously, but, budget. You know, it's still pretty bad fight scene.
Yeah.
I never feel too concerned for Val Kilmer in this scene.
Yeah.
Then Jack makes his way to Vegas to find Faye, where she's staying under a slightly different name, which is, again, ridiculous. Like, why wouldn't you change your name completely if you're trying to hide from people?
Yeah. Well, the thing that struck me about this character, I think if there's something he learned from writing this character and writing the Fiorentino character in Last Seduction, is that, like, that character, the Fiorentino character, has great instincts and is super fucking smart. This character, I think, has good instincts but is not too bright and does not really think things all the way through in the way that the later one did, and that's much more compelling to watch.
And like I said before, this film relies on so many coincidences. Yeah. And in this moment, we have Jack trying to get to Faye's room by saying he's delivering a package, but he gets shot down. So he goes and takes a drink and just happens to sit right next to the craps table where she's playing.
Yeah.
This is a casino. Casinos are huge.
Yeah.
The chances of you just walking up and finding somebody you're looking for.
Pretty slim.
Pretty slim, especially when he didn't know what, you know, where she was. I don't believe he knew where she was, at least.
Yeah.
Never came up.
Yes.
But at the same time, the guys that Faye and Vince robbed also were able to track her down.
Yeah. It's a very small, I mean, it's what's the expression? The biggest small town in the, anyway. Yeah. Yeah. It certainly proves to be the case.
And the reason they were able to find her is because the money Jack gave to the thugs had a green rubber band on it. That was it. That's the whole thing.
That's what we're going with.
They found her room number based on that.
I will say this. I will say this in Mr. Dahl's defense. A lot of great films noir have thinner coincidences than that to hang their hats on. That's all I'll say.
Understandable, but
it's a lot.
There's also probably some other stuff going on that's making you not notice that.
It's a lot. It's true.
Either way, the guy from the robbery IDs Jack and Faye, and they find the money, and then the one thug is going to kill them, but Faye shoots them. There's a line here, and I'm going to play it for you because I need you to explain to me what was happening with this character.
Okay.
There it is. There it is, on the floor. That's my briefcase.
Why is he crying about his briefcase?
Look, here's what I admire. You, when you're a day player, you want to invest as much backstory as you can. You really want to like make the most of every moment on screen. And what I would like to think is this fine young actor had decided that that briefcase had been a gift from someone very, very special in his life. You know, maybe an ex-girlfriend who really broke his heart, perhaps a parent or maybe even a grandmother who cared for him in a time of need. And it meant a lot to him to get that briefcase back. That's what I would like to think.
It's very upsetting that I'm willing to accept that as a legitimate reason for that to happen.
Yeah, you're right. He really is quite emotional about the briefcase.
It's become a theme on this show where too much credit is given to people. for what they do in these films.
Right.
And I'm going to go along with that for that one, that we may be giving him too much credit. But hey,
there's a chance.
It was a good theory for sure.
Yes. Thank you.
Looking at this room, I love old school Vegas decor. Oh my God. The gaudiness.
It's a great set. Yeah.
Oh, the Art Deco. I mean, I couldn't live in a place like this, but God, do I want to visit it because it looks amazing. Bless the, I'm assuming they just found the room, but.
No, you're right. Yes.
That this was what Vegas was at the time.
Fine work by the location manager there, yes.
On the run from the gunman, we get another odd scene when Jack drives Faye to the police station because she's freaking out and confessing everything. There's two things about this scene.
Okay.
First, Kilmer's staring acting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
For over a minute, I clocked it because I couldn't believe it. For over a minute, his only output in the scene is to look at Wally and then look out the window and then look back at Wally and then look out the window.
Mm-hmm.
That's all he does for over a minute, and they keep cutting back to him. Each time they cut back to him, I couldn't believe it. I was like, this is getting more and more ridiculous. That this is all he's doing in the scene.
Yeah. Again, you know, underplaying it.
I get that, you know, there's only so much you can do in a scene between two people sitting in a car and one of them has a ton of dialogue to get through.
Right.
But give me something. Like you just turn the head back to there, back to there, back to there.
Yeah.
I want to know what he's thinking in his head as he's doing that. I need an audio commentary. Explain yourself, Mr. Kilmer. What is happening in this moment? What are you thinking?
Yeah. That'd be a good name for his podcast. Explain Yourself with Val Kilmer.
The other thing about the scene that stands out to me, so you've got this woman who's quite hysterical in this car.
Mm-hmm. She did just kill a man.
Yes. And a cop walks up and asks, everything okay in here?
Mm-hmm.
And when he says she's just a little upset, he's like, okay. Just walks away.
Real McGruff the crime dog there, real sniffing things out.
The tone of his voice is absolutely 100% that of, I am not getting involved in this.
And good for him. Good call.
I want to know what the auditions were like for that role.
Yeah. I mean, he made the right call because later in the movie, she just straight up starts shooting at cops. Like that guy doesn't know how close he came.
Yeah. Premonition there.
Yeah. Get a bad vibe from her.
Back at the hotel, Jack and Faye, they get down to it. We're in a hotel where Jack used to bring his wife, I believe. So I guess he's over her. I guess that's done with.
Guess so. Or, you know, like I said, there's a resemblance. Maybe do a little cosplay. We don't know. Whatever his thing is his thing.
No, I'm not kink shaming.
Nope. Not at all.
So they talk about the future and Jack's idea. He wants to move to Maine. Like he was going to do with his wife. So I guess he's just going to turn Faye into his wife, which I see makes sense because she's wearing like a house coat and like very odd look for her in that room.
Yep.
And they find out that they're wanted for murder for the guy in the room and they have to figure out a way to get away.
Yep.
So... this is the moment when Faye comes up with the title of the movie, telling Jack, kill me again.
4-star title and dialogue moment.
Do you think Dahl wrote this scene first, or he got to this point and went, Stephen J. Cannell, and just threw the paper?
I would like to think both, frankly. I'd like to think he knew it was going there, and then when it got there, it was like, job well done. Time for a martini.
I was like, oh my God. He did it. He put it right
there.
And it worked.
Yeah.
I was all for it because, you know, in a movie like this, you can totally go for that. And it's
absolutely
more than acceptable.
Absolutely.
After calling Alan in the guitar studio, I love Alan's sets. He's got some weird stuff going on his own.
Yeah.
Jack and Faye plan to fake their deaths in the middle of Lake Mead. And meanwhile, Vince is grilling Alan about Faye's whereabouts, claiming that he knew Faye was not dead somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how he managed that.
Yeah.
Again, coincidences.
Yeah.
Either way, Alan ends up getting murdered, and I was so bummed for Alan.
I know. He didn't do anything wrong. He's just being a good buddy. But, I mean, he did answer his own question of what's the worst that could happen.
And we know now.
Pretty much the worst that could happen.
And again, after he's killed, falls in slow motion for no reason.
Well, you know, it was still the 80s. There was a lot of slow motion in the 80s. It was in the air.
It just... Your movie, for the most part, is straightforward in presentation. When you do something like that, you try to get stylistic, it pulls you right out of the movie.
No, it's
like,
true.
I wanted to like this movie, you know, and because, again, you know, it's a Kilmer cast, and I like Val Kilmer.
Yep.
But when things like that happen, it's just like, no, I'm sorry. Yeah. I cannot abide by that.
Yeah.
So Jack leaves to bury the money because he's going to set up this whole escape plan for the faking your death, which makes Faye very nervous, which makes sense because she can't trust anybody because nobody can trust her.
Right.
So at the gas station, Jack sees the roadblock and focuses on the sign for Arizona. I believe he's thinking about running. I would think you would think the same, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I feel like this is the point where we should be building to a climax, but it feels like the film is stuck in neutral.
Yeah, I could see that. I also, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but I also do like the fact that it ends on the Arizona sign, because then it really does feel like Red Rock West is like a direct sequel to this movie, or at least part of like the Dahl cinematic universe.
Absolutely. Bring them all together.
Absolutely.
He returns to Faye after burying the money and gets hit by Vince, who has tracked him down. And Vince is now looking for the money. I think Dahl has done a decent job at this writing this film, you know, even though there's plot issues here and there. But the lines that he gives Michael Madsen to say in this moment are so bad.
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Half-Ass Dick Tracy.
That doesn't even make sense. Dick Tracy was a cop.
And when he says, she's right, I am fucking nuts. Like, don't be so direct.
Yeah.
Guy is like a lunatic. I want him just to be saying crazy as, you know, Charlie Manson level stuff. And you've got him doing this dumb stuff over here on the side. Straighten him out.
Right. But again, like I say, the physicality of what Madsen's up to in this scene, really, really gruesome, really... really effective. And like I say, a torture scene a couple of years before Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah. The only thing is Vince is a terrible criminal because
that's true.
He gets, Jack calls his bluff with the gun right to his head and then calls his bluff with a gun to Faye's head. And it's like, well, now what?
He's out of place.
And at this point, this scene feels like it's going on at least its second hour because it just drags on. And then eventually Jack's in the closet as Vince attempts to rape Faye, I believe. Right in front of Jack?
Something along those lines, yes.
Yeah. And she ends up shooting him, and they're on the run again.
Yep.
And I'm like, oh, okay, well, something interesting happened here. Off to Vince, and now Jack and Faye can live their life, but we're still a good amount of time left. So where are we going with this?
Yeah.
So, you know, so as Jack is digging up the money because they go to find the suitcase to get out of town, up walks Vince.
There he is.
And I was like, whoa. And then Faye shoots Jack.
That's a good old-fashioned double cross, my friend.
I didn't see this coming. Did you?
No, me neither. I mean, I was a bit of the sap at that moment. And that's the thing you got to keep in mind is that, like, ultimately she is going to double cross and double cross and double cross.
Mm. She ends up shooting him and shoots him again, and he falls into the water. And Vince and Faye take Jack's car. And as they get away, Faye opens up the suitcase, which is filled with junk. And the cops are on their trail. Way to go, Jack.
Yeah, nice. Like, that's a nice trick right there.
Yeah, and way to go coincidences, because considering we now know that Jack hid the money in a different place, what was his plan?
Okay, well, I didn't think that part through. I was sort of It worked in the moment. How's that?
Yeah, I'll agree. It wasn't until I went back and looked at it again that I said,
right.
Okay, so if he goes back, buries the money, he goes back mm-hmm. to Faye, which is what his plan was.
Right.
Now what? You know, you have to take Faye somewhere.
He digs up the first one. He's like, okay, this was your test one. Now let's go to the real one, crazy kook. And then, gives her a little, noogie and off they go. Yeah, there you go. Explained. Yep.
The question is, did he not really fall for her? Because if he did, why would you bury both suitcases?
Okay. Yep. Also fine. But, you can fall for people, but still be careful. That's just good, solid looking out for number one.
This is a lot of looking out.
There is indeed.
So the kids on the reservation end up saving Jack, pulling mm-hmm. him out of the water.
Yep.
Starting that whole run of, Thunderheart and all the other films that Kilmer will be in.
Yep.
And meanwhile, Vince and Faye are making their getaway. And in my favorite moment of the entire film, they drive directly into a propane tank and explode.
Yes.
I laughed so hard when this happened.
Yeah, it's a lot.
I don't know if it was intended to be comedy.
Yeah. It's not a well executed stunt sequence. We'll say that. And then of course we cut back to
Jack has the money.
Yes. Yes.
And he's driven into Arizona in the back of the truck. And that's it.
I, as you could tell, I cut this movie a lot of slack because I like John Dahl mm-hmm. and I like what he's doing. The ending made me very angry.
Oh yeah.
Because it is, if you're making a noir, then you've got to do a noir ending. You cannot do this 80s cop-out feel-good bullshit ending. Like mm-hmm. that ending is a complete fucking cop-out, because a real film noir would have ended with all three of them dead and the money in a hole in the ground that no one would ever find. Yeah. Like, that is your bleak.
Or the kids find the money, maybe.
Or the kid, maybe even that. But,
but not likely.
There's a fundamental hopelessness that should exist throughout a good film noir, all the way through to the end, to literally the end on the screen. And they came so close to it in this one.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was Dahl trying to make a commercial ending, or if that was, you can't do that ending like imposed upon him by someone with power. But whichever way it goes, they really blow it at the end there.
Admittedly, I was kind of excited when I thought that Faye and Vince were getting away with the money. And I was like,
that'd be fine too.
Is this a dark ending? It's Arlington Road.
Yes.
But that explosion. And what's funny is that I had a file of this film that I watched the first mm-hmm. time I watched it, and the movie ended at the explosion.
Oh my.
Something was wrong. The file got corrupted.
Oh God.
And so I was like, wait, that's the end of the movie?
That's a hell of an ending, right?
There's no credits. So I found another file of it, and then I watched the complete ending of the film, and I was like, oh, that's worse.
Yeah. Would have thought that would be the good way to end. Yeah. Yeah.
But man, I haven't had a good laugh like that in a movie like this in a long time. Watch these two drive into a propane tank.
Oopsie.
Oh, it is the best.
A convenient roadside propane tank.
Is there anything we haven't covered about this film that you wanted to talk about?
No. I think we've given more thought and consideration to this movie than certainly anyone has since 1989, and perhaps since its production, if even then.
This is very true.
There is a lot that I like about it. Like, again, I took it a little easy on it. I think I like a lot of the noir touches. Mm-hmm. I think Madsen is terrific. I think she is magnificent.
Absolutely.
But Kilmer's way miscast, and there's a lot that doesn't hold together well at all.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. There's about one moment in this film of Kilmer that I was like, that's the Kilmer I like.
There's my guy. There he is. No, come back. Come back.
It's like, how'd that happen?
Yeah.
But, that's why we're doing a lot of these films, so we can find the stuff we actually like about his career.
There you go.
So we talked a lot about the film, so let's hear from the man himself.
It's time for a reading from the Book of Val.
So our reading today comes from Val Kilmer's memoir, I'm Your Huckleberry. I'm not really surprised that Kill Me Again is not mentioned once in this book.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
But he did have this to say about his co-star. After spending the day as Nick Rivers singing Skeet Surfing, a song about shooting ski with a shotgun while surfing, I was ready for something serious. I walked a few blocks from my flat to experience what I thought would be the glory of English acting. I don't remember much about the play, The Genius, but the lead actress, 21-year-old Joanne Whalley, stole my heart. It wasn't the first time I'd fallen in love, nor was it the first time I'd fallen in love at first sight, but it was the first time I'd fallen in love at first sight from a distance. Thanks be to Val. You know, I understand when you make a film with somebody you love like this, and you've seen it time and time again with married or will be married pairings. But I think your theory is a very good one, that he made this movie to have her have a film.
Right.
Because, you know, she wasn't the biggest star at the time. And this was a really good opportunity, I think, for her to make her mark as a femme fatale.
Yeah, and if anybody had seen the movie, then it might have done some good. But boy, yeah, those box office figures are pretty fucking bleak.
Yeah, it's not good. Yeah. I always hate, you know, I'm a critic, and people think critics hate movies for some reason. Mm-hmm. When all we do is love movies.
Right.
And it hurts when I see somebody put so much effort into something and then nobody watched it.
Yeah.
That's the worst feeling.
Yeah.
Unless it's terrible. If it's absolutely terrible, then...
Right, you know. But, it does feel... every video store I've worked at had a copy of it. It rented out occasionally, especially sort of in the post-Tombstone era when suddenly everybody was crazy about Val Kilmer.
Mm.
I think it has enjoyed something of an afterlife. Certainly a few more people have seen it. But, yeah, not much of a cultural footprint on this one.
No. So let's see what other people had to say about this film.
Come, children, let's explore the Kills and Valleys.
Kills and Valleys are the best and worst reviews of this film. There aren't a lot of reviews of Kill Me Again out there, but the few I could find were interesting to read. Mick LaSalle of the San Francisco Chronicle got right to the point with his review. The picture looks like it cost about 3 cents to make, but it packs a nice punch with tense moments, unexpected turns, and a hot performance by Joanne Whalley Kilmer.
That's pretty accurate.
Yeah, you can't argue with that, man.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, John Hartle of the Seattle Times wrote, "The first-time director and co-writer, John Dahl, has a veteran's assurance. He knows exactly what he wants from the actors, how to stage the tricky action, how to keep the plot comprehensible, how to use the Nevada-Arizona locations to suggest the aridness of the characters' lives. He doesn't break any new ground with Kill Me Again, but he does establish himself as a filmmaker to watch."
That ended up being quite true.
Yeah, he gave a little more credit, again, a theme in the show, giving more credit than deserved, but he got to the right point at the end, which was Dahl was establishing himself, and not everybody hits it out of the park the first time, especially with a low-budget film.
Yeah.
On the other side of the ledger, we get an uncredited staff review from The Time Out. These are always my favorite kinds of reviews to read because they never pull any punches.
Right.
Since they don't have to put their name on it, so they don't care. So, derived from assorted Hitchcock's and noir classics, the torturous storyline of writer-director Dahl's determinedly sordid thriller has its moments, but the whole thing is fatally scuppered by the Kilmer pairing. Joanne is trying far too hard and looks like it, while Val, whose pudgy baby face makes nonsense of his world-weary, tough-guy posturing, alternates between two expressions, troubled, unsmiling, and beguiled, faintly smiling. Setting its study of betrayal and deceit in and around the gambling towns of the Nevada desert, the film sporadically achieves a truly seedy atmosphere, but there are too many symbols, too many loose ends, and too many vaguely sensational scenes.
Hmm. Well, they're wrong about her, but they're right about him.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah.
they got right to the meat on that one, where he doesn't look like a noir hero, and he doesn't act like one either.
No.
Now that the pros have had their say, let's take a look at how the film fared in the unwashed masses of Amazon.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, there are 96 reviews, and 58% of them are 5-star.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
If anything, Val Kilmer fans are loyal.
That's an excellent point. Excellent.
A keeper, one of Val's better films, I think. But that's just me. His ex-wife plays in this movie too. I don't think she had much acting to do to play the part she played. She seemed in her element. Understandable why they divorced in real life.
Wow. Well, that is a close reading right there. That's really, really making some assumptions there. Yeah. Oh my goodness. All right.
Val's fans, very loyal to Val.
yeah, apparently so.
It is a shame, in my opinion, that this movie never got enough attention when it was released. I consider it a fine example of film noir and possibly the best film noir movie to appear in the 90s.
Mm.
If you like well-paced detective movies, you will love this film. Joanne Whalley Kilmer plays one of the best evil women I've seen in some time. You gotta love to hate her in this movie.
It's not even one of the best noir films of the 90s by that director.
I gotta tell you, the amount of times that this film is referenced as a top noir film is frankly upsetting.
Ooh, okay. All right.
Too often.
Yeah.
Only 6% of the reviews were one star. Mm-hmm. This one focused on the most important elements of the film.
Okay.
The delivery was great. The movie was boring.
I do love the ones. Yes, those are my favorite ones. Came 2 days later than expected. One star.
When we did Willow,
yeah,
almost every one-star review was about how it was either a counterfeit copy or a Korean DVD that they couldn't play in their DVD player. It's part of the joy of the Amazon review.
Yes, indeed.
This review is titled Film Snoir.
Oh, I see what you did there. Yeah.
I think they were attempting to combine snore and noir.
Yeah, that's
doesn't
right.
quite work, but hey, no. why not? No. John Dahl's myopic homage to film noir opens with a slow brooding pan across high desert, underscored by absurdly dramatic music, and then it gets bad. Spoiler alert, Madsen, Kilmer, and Wally each take a turn trying to overact their way out of paper bag and then find out that they can't. The end.
That seems a little harsh.
It does. I mean, say what you want about Kilmer's performance. Say, you know, Wally, I think Wally's good. But you can't say bad things about Madsen's performance in this film.
No, no, certainly not.
I don't know if I would say that Kilmer overacted at any point, though.
No, no, no.
That would have been welcome.
Yeah.
He tried I'd to go nuts it. In this film.
I'd have taken it.
So we have a decision to make.
With or without Val.
Does Val Kilmer make or break this movie?
Oh, he breaks it. I mean the man no disrespect, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I think, and there are certain problems, obviously, with the picture that are not, that do not lay at his feet. But I think with an actor more suited to the role, it could have come together a little bit better.
Mm. Definitely. I really think this is Wally's film more than anything.
Absolutely.
She pushes it forward and Kilmer is basically along for the ride. The story happens to Jack. It doesn't. He's not an active portion of almost any
right.
of it.
Right.
And that's not a good thing for that's your protagonist in the film, which yeah. we are expected to believe that he is the protagonist, especially when the film ends.
And again, that's not a quality that he typically embodies as an actor. He's a very proactive presence in most of his best work.
Yeah, I really, like you said before, I'd really love to know why he made this movie. You know, like we have our theory, but it's just such a weird entry in his early filmography.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about it. It followed Top Secret, Real Genius, Top Gun, and Willow.
Yeah.
And then the next film he made was The Doors.
Yeah.
Where did this come from?
These are all big budget, or at least mid-budget, studio releases with name directors, and then to sort of slide in this kind of little nowhere neo-noir from a first-time director on a low budget. It's there's a story here, and if he doesn't tell it in his book, then I'm assuming we're never going to know it.
Most likely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If this was his first film, it would make a lot more sense.
Oh, totally.
So that's it for this episode of KilmerCast. I'd like to thank you, Jason, for joining me on this film to chat. Do you have anything you'd like to plug?
Again, my podcast is the main thing at this point. It's called Fun City Cinema, and you can grab it on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcast, wherever you're listening to this podcast. And the book that accompanies it will be out next year, fall of 2021. So I would appreciate if you would, subscribe and listen and rate and review. I've turned into one of those guys. But we're very proud of the podcast. I think it's to a good start.
Yeah, the production is fantastic.
Thank you.
So I'd like to plug an amazing artist by the name of Amy Dresser. She's an illustrator and photo retoucher, and she just blows me away with the art she creates. You can check out some of her stuff and get in touch with her for your own retouching needs at amydresser.com. You got to check out the before and after section because she shows the images she was given from the photographer and then what it ends up as. And it's amazing the difference between what it started as and what she did to it. And so definitely check that out. In our next episode, we'll be digging into one of Kilmer's spookier films as we tackle the 2011 Francis Ford Coppola film Twixt. In the meanwhile, please email any thoughts, questions, or comments to kilmercast@gmail.com and follow the show on Twitter @KilmerCast. For myself and my guest, Jason Bailey, thanks for listening, and remember to keep it Kilmer.